This is Thin Blue Crime, a true crime podcast discussing some of America's most dangerous criminals, the police. Examining both the crimes of the past and current movements to imagine a police-free future. This week, we'll be discussing Daniel Holtzclaw, the Oklahoma City police officer who was convicted of multiple counts of rape in 2015. We discuss how power plays into sexual violence and how policing is inherently linked to oppressive power and dominance. Tune in.
This is a case, actually, I like really went back and forth for a while about covering, but have you seen all of the stuff about, I think his name's Daniel Chloe? I don't know how to pronounce his last name, but he's friends with Ali Wong and Stephen Wen, and he's in that new show Beef. Okay, well, he's this like comedian guy, I guess, who like bragged on a podcast about raping someone. Yeah, and it started this whole conversation, particularly about like anti-blackness within the Asian community. And from that, a lot of people started talking about this guy who we're about to talk about in the case, because they're like, hey, remember when that like Asian police officer was like assaulting women, and people still are like, he's innocent? And I'm like, oh, yes, I do, because I thought about talking about that case. And that's what we're doing today. We're talking about that case. It is a lot. So let's get into it. Hi, I'm Hannah.
Hi, I'm Chris.
And this is Thin Blue Crime, your friendly neighborhood abolitionist true crime podcast. I am just going to say this episode is a little controversial. I was just telling Chris, this is a story I've wanted to tell, but I've been nervous to tell because there's a lot of controversy around this case, but controversy be damned. We're gonna tell this story. Because what? We're gonna let some fear of controversy stop us? We're literally an abolitionist true crime podcast. We're pretty controversial as it is.
I also think a lot of times things that are, and I don't even know what this case is, but a lot of times when we say controversial, I'm like, oh, you want people to be like cared for and protected and have what they need to survive and not be harassed by the state? You're so radical. You're so crazy and controversial.
It is kind of funny to me sometimes that like so much of what we believe and so much of what we talk about is viewed as radical and controversial, when if you really think about it and you really dig deep into it, you're like, no, it's not controversial. That makes a lot of sense. Our society is just kind of fucked.
Literally fucked.
So anyway, this week we will be talking about, like I said, a more controversial case. And I'm also going to go ahead and leave a trigger warning, because this week we will be talking about Daniel Holtzclaw, who was convicted of sexually assaulting multiple women while working for the Oklahoma City Police Department. So some people might remember this case as happening around the same time as the Ferguson protests. I don't want to say like Ferguson Black Lives Matter protests, because that's what happened in Ferguson was like not necessarily part of the Black Lives Matter protest. But, you know, this is in the wake of the murder of Michael Brown by Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson. And while it didn't get nearly as much coverage as Michael Brown's case, it did become a rallying cry for many Black Lives Matter activists in the years after, because it was Black women that Daniel was targeting. However, like I said, this case is kind of controversial for a few reasons. The first being that because this was unfolding during the Ferguson protests, it was a very politically complicated time. Many people were desperate for police accountability, but others were desperate to defend police from any and all attacks. Another thing controversial about this case is there's very, very little forensic evidence, which a lot of people don't like. You know, they want to see the DNA, they want to see the fingerprints and all of that. And for me, I don't think that lack of forensic evidence is surprising, considering the perpetrators of this crime is a cop who would have known better than to leave behind forensic evidence, but that has definitely made people question certain aspects of this case. And then finally, like, when we talk about all the sneaky, dirty tactics used to convict people in our justice system, those very same tactics were used against Daniel. For example, Daniel is an Asian man and he faced an all-white jury. So, truth be told, this is not like a clean investigational prosecution. One last thing that made this controversial is not only was he targeting Black women, he was targeting Black women in poor communities, most of whom had criminal justice, criminal records. So, you know, there's a lot of complicated details, but something that I want to make clear is I will always believe women when they talk about sexual assault. Data shows that very, very few women lie about sexual assault. And me personally, I would rather support a liar than a rapist. So if I'm wrong, if we're wrong in covering this case, and I don't know, magically, we find out that none of what I'm about to talk about is true, I can rest well knowing, okay, so I believed a liar rather than I believed a rapist.
Mm.
But I don't think I'm wrong, and we're going to get to that. So, starting at the beginning, Daniel Hatzclaw was born in Guam in December of 1986 to a family in the Air Force. He had two older sisters, both of whom still proclaim his innocence and say that he's never done anything that would indicate that he would commit these crimes. Both of his parents were police officers. He attended school in Oklahoma, where he played football and was eventually offered a D1 football scholarship. He was a linebacker. I actually listened to another podcast about this case, where they pointed out that linebackers are big guys that tackle people, and police officers sure do love to tackle people. He played football at Eastern Michigan University, where he studied criminal justice. And he, after graduating, did attempt to enter the NFL, but he was not picked up in the draft and had to return to Oklahoma. And
there were chip on your shoulder.
Hmm?
I said it's giving chip on your shoulder.
Well, it definitely is, because there's reports that he was like very surprised to not get picked up in the draft and very disappointed. Like, I think I saw a report that he actually had a reporter there to like talk to him when he was drafted, and then he wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely chip on shoulder. Also, again, like, long history in law enforcement. Parents were in the Air Force and then cops, you know. So when interviewed about why he wanted to become a police officer, he said, "I have always thought police work would be an interesting field to go into, but both my mother and father were police officers. And my father had a long career with the Air Force Security Police and is now a lieutenant at the Enid Police Department. I always looked up to my dad and admired his role as a police officer. I've always thought public service was very important to giving back to the community and protecting it. I have always lived ethically and tried to be a positive role model for others." Why do we hear that so much from these cops that go on to commit crimes? That, like,
I think that's such a red flag to say I have always lived ethically, because I feel really proud of like my morals and like the life choices I've made, and I don't feel like I could say that. Like, we live in such like a harmful society and we're working within such harmful systems. Like, I don't think I've always lived ethically.
What does it even mean to live ethically, first of all?
Yeah.
Another thing I do have to just say, he's very religious. Everything I've read was that he is very religious, and I'm sure that ties in it too.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing for me, and we hear this a lot with these officers, is he says, "I always thought public service was very important to giving back to the community and protecting it." You want to give back to the community. In what ways does policing do that? What are they giving? I've never seen police give anything other than a bad attitude.
the idea of giving back, I'm like, okay, so what has the, like, if you're actually thinking about giving back to the community, you need to think about what the community has given you that you can give back. Mm-hmm. I don't think anyone can, or very few people can really think, oh, police have given me this. Not they protect me, they keep me safe. No, specifically actual things that have made your life better. Like, it's not coming from cops.
At all. So his fellow police said that he was a very hard worker, which is its own kind of red flag to me. But there are reports that he received several complaints of excessive force while working for the Oklahoma City Police Department. Oklahoma City has actually paid out several lawsuits related to his excessive force. So clearly he has a history of abusing power as a police officer. Then there was this incident in May of 2013. On May 1st, 2013, Daniel responded to a call from the mother of Clifton Armstrong. She called because her son was struggling with delusions and paranoia as a result of methamphetamine usage. When Daniel and three other officers arrived, they attempted to convince Armstrong to go to the hospital before eventually subduing him outside of the home. When officers tried to get him into the car, a physical confrontation ensued. And according to police, at some point, Armstrong stripped off his clothes and became very unruly. This led officers to place him in handcuffs and use belts to restrain his legs and his lower body. At some point while this was going on, Clifton became unresponsive and was ultimately declared dead. All of the officers involved in this incident were cleared of any wrongdoing, and the autopsy said that this death was related to the methamphetamine usage. And that may be true, but I don't know. This is like, to me, like, where there's smoke, there's fire. He's got the excessive force complaints. He's got this incident where a person in his custody died.
Right. Like, that's something that always blows my mind is, like, custody to me means that it's your job to take care of someone. So if someone dies in your custody, that shouldn't be like some automatic fault. And like, even if it was drug related, you don't care for someone who's experiencing like any sort of like drug related reaction by tying them down.
No, like, that's exactly not what you're supposed to do. Like, that,
right?
I don't know. Also, to your point, yeah, one of the only times that police actually have an obligation to take care of you is when you are in their custody. Like, it is the only time that they have to actually give a shit about you. Anyways, this leads us to June 18th, 2014, at 2 a.m. when he was ending his shift on the northeast side of Oklahoma City. Allegedly, he switched off his patrol car computer, and then, without notifying his station and calling for assistance, he made a traffic stop. Now, this is not proper protocol. There was absolutely no reason for Daniel to conduct a traffic stop, especially when he was off the job. And I feel like this is something we see a lot too. Police getting involved in things that aren't their business when they aren't on the clock. And I almost feel like, and maybe I'm wrong, police act more recklessly when they aren't on the clock because they still feel like empowered by the job, but they don't feel limited by like any sort of oversight when they're not on the clock.
And it just makes me think about like how fake their job is. Like, I don't know anyone who's overworked who chooses to do more during their time off.
No, because like, I actually think that my job is important to society, and 5 o'clock hits, I'm done.
Yeah.
Like, this job is a lot of work. It's very draining. It's hard. I'm not going to do extra.
Yeah. Exactly.
I mean,
if I saw one of my kids out and about in the city, as I often do, and they were in trouble, I would be there and I would stay with them. But if I saw one of my kids at the train station and they're being a little bit rowdy, I'd be like, headphones on, I'm going home. You know?
Yeah, I mean, like, if you see your kid out at the park, are you going to give them homework out at the park?
Right, exactly.
Be like, no. Actually, everybody, hey, I know that we're not in class right now, but can you sit down? I have a quick lesson for you. Like, no. So why are cops who are not on the clock doing that work? Like, and don't feed me the bullshit of like, well, they're just really wanting to protect and serve. No, they're not.
A traffic stop? Like, come on.
Who are you serving and protecting with a traffic stop?
No. I think anyone, even the pro cop people, really. Traffic stops, really. No. You hate.
I mean, I don't even think we should have traffic stops. So that's a whole other thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, the woman he stopped was a 57-year-old grandmother who was driving home after playing dominoes with a friend. The victim, who was identified as JL in court, couldn't roll down her broken driver's side window. So she actually got out of the car right away, which I imagine was terrifying for her. Daniel directed her to the rear passenger side of his patrol car after she got out. And he asked if she had been drinking, which she hadn't. But he didn't believe that because she had a styrofoam cup in her front seat. She explained that she doesn't drink and that the cup was Kool-Aid, even offering him a sip to check. He asks her if she has anything on her and tells her if she tells him now that he won't take her to jail, which is something cops do all the time. They'll be like, oh, if you tell me now, I won't get you in trouble. And that's a lie. Never tell the cops anything, ever.
As my mom so brilliantly put it, police are trained to lie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So just, again, a trigger warning, because the next section is going to be describing an incident between Daniel and JL. But, and normally I wouldn't go into like detail about stuff like this. Like, people, you all have been listening for a while. Like, normally we don't get real graphic about these cases, and I'm not about to get super graphic about this either. But like, I think that this story needs to be told in full. So Daniel directed JL to lift up her shirt so that he could check for drugs. She lifted the shirt up over her stomach, but he then complained that he couldn't see enough and that there might be something in her bra. I just want to say, I looked it up. Oklahoma City police policy is to call a female officer to do a complete search when a female suspect is asked to lift their shirt above their belly. He did not do that. Remember, he didn't contact anyone about this traffic stop. At Daniel's insistence, JL grabbed the bottom of her bra and shook it to show that there was nothing in there. But again, he said that that was not good enough. He forced her to expose her breasts, and Daniel shined a flashlight over them. And at that point, she noticed that he was touching himself. Daniel then asked her to pull down her pants, which she did, though she kept her underwear on. Daniel flashes flashlight over her like lower area. And when JL looked up, Daniel's penis was out, and he forced her into oral contact before telling her to stop and following her home. As soon as she got home, she and her daughter called the local police and went to the station to file a report. The on-call detective for the sex crimes unit would later recount that JL's report was similar to an unsolved assault in May of 2014. And this would spark an investigation that would lead detectives to at least six other women who said that they were assaulted by Daniel while he was on duty. All of these women were Black, and all of them had criminal records. When Daniel returned to his station the afternoon after JL filed her report, he was immediately pulled aside and taken to the department's sex crimes unit by detectives Kim Davis and Rocky Gregory for questioning. He was then Mirandized and underwent a two-hour interrogation, during which he denied all accusations of misconduct during the stop earlier that evening, and buckle swabs, which is your cheek. Buckle swabs were taken for DNA comparison. At the conclusion of the interrogation, the two detectives told Daniel that they believed that he was being untruthful based both on previous evidence and on contradictory statements made by Carrie Hunt, his 25-year-old girlfriend whom he lived with at the time. While Daniel was ultimately released after this interrogation, his commission and entry cards, uniform, shirt, and pants, badges, firearms, radio, and keys to his assigned vehicles were seized, and he was placed on indefinite paid administrative leave. After further investigation eventually turned up a dozen additional complaints, Daniel was arrested 2 months later on August 21st, 2014, and originally charged with 16, but eventually 36 counts of sexual abuse offenses, including rape in the first and second degrees, sexual battery, procuring lewd exhibition, stalking, and forcible oral sodomy. So while investigating this, detectives reviewed Daniel's automatically recorded history of running names through their databases and found that he would run the names of certain women several times. So they went and talked to these women and said that they just received a tip that there might have been an incident. And several of these women came forward at that time with stories of how Daniel assaulted them. And they even were able to say like where it happened. And detectives were able to cross-reference those stories with GPS records from Daniel's patrol car. So for example, they found a victim who Daniel allegedly picked up from an apartment complex known for drug use, put her in his back seat, drove her two blocks away to check her name for existing warrants, and searched her purse, where he allegedly found a crack pipe. She asked him to just stomp on the pipe and call it good, which is something that like cops will do for people who like don't know. Even like I had a friend back in high school who got pulled over and the cops found her with a bowl for smoking weed. And the cop was like, just throw it out the window. Like, I'm not gonna let you keep it, but I'm not gonna stop you. So like, that's like not an unusual thing to ask. So she was like, oh, just stomp on it. We'll call it good. But Daniel instead got out of the car and exposed himself to her. She then performed oral sex on him for a few minutes before he tells her to stop and offers her a ride home, which she declines. He insists, however, and then drives her to an open field area where she's like terrified now. Like she doesn't know where she is. She doesn't know what's going to happen. And he stops there just long enough to get her real scared and then drives her home. And again, the victim was able to describe the route that he drove her, which perfectly matched the GPS record in his car.
Wow.
And this is the thing. Daniel patrolled low-income neighborhoods looking for victims. Like his region for his work was in these low-income areas that were predominantly people of color. Nearly every single accuser had a history of either drug abuse, prostitution, or some sort of outstanding warrant when Daniel stopped them. This is why JL was such a big deal, because JL had no criminal record. She wasn't even in the neighborhood. She wasn't even from the neighborhood she was pulled over in. She was just driving through. But he saw her, a Black woman, and assumed that she would be like his other victims who were too afraid to speak up. But JL was not. The strength that she must have had to like speak out immediately is incredible.
Right, against a police officer of all things.
Like, yeah. Well, and if she hadn't, imagine how long this could have been going on. Because there were women that did come forward. And they were ignored, which Daniel knew would happen. And that's the reality for a lot of like criminals. They prey on poor people, Black people, people with criminal records, people who are immigrants, people who don't speak English, because they know that even if those people go to the police, which most of them would not, they won't be believed. Mm-hmm. You think a police officer is going to believe a woman who is struggling with addiction,
right,
or another police officer? One victim he visited repeatedly, this victim who goes by the initials TB, was asked, like the other woman, to lift her shirt so that he could search for drugs. GPS records show that Daniel then repeatedly would return to TB's house. At one point, even entering the house without permission, waking up TB's boyfriend and telling him to go outside so that he could run his name for warrants while he stayed inside with TB. He even pulled up to her house while she was with her kids and told her to step back to his patrol car just so that he could assault her again. And he allegedly told her, "We can take care of these warrants, just play by my rules." Eventually, police brought together 13 women who were willing to come forward and testify, though evidence suggests that there were many other women who were also involved that just didn't feel comfortable testifying or that prosecutors felt wouldn't be reliable witnesses. The earliest incident discovered in these many crimes that Daniel committed was from December 20th, 2013, where a woman actually said she had been arrested for drug possession and hospitalized and was forced to give oral sex while in handcuffs in her hospital bed. She said that he made sexual advances on her on several occasions after she was released from jail as well. The woman said that she was led to believe that she would be released if she performed oral sex on Daniel and said, "I didn't think no one would believe me." She testified at a pretrial hearing. "I feel like all police work together." And I think, I mean, that goes to what we talk about so much is who do you go to when the police are the ones that are causing you harm?
Right. And just, oh God, even the way we view police, like, the fact that he had the access to comfortably do this in a hospital. Like, he's not her family. Why is he alone with her in her room? Like, and there's obvious answers to that, but yeah, we really need to, if we're gonna keep police around, we need to really rethink the access that they have to people who are extremely vulnerable.
Well, it's because society has so much trust in police. We're told that these people are there to protect us and that we can trust them. I think that's something that, like, young children are instilled very, very early. You can trust police. If you're in trouble, you go to the police.
Yeah.
But by giving them that much community trust, societal trust, you're giving them a lot of power to cause harm. Because the reality is, most of the times when you're going to be a victim, it'll be by someone you trust, by someone you know. And if you're trusting police, it's more easy to be victimized.
I mean,
not to victim, and that's not like to victim shame, like, obviously.
Right.
But this is what society has done. Society has put them in a position to exploit.
Right. I mean, the fact at all that she was handcuffed in a hospital bed.
Yeah. So while he had originally been on paid administrative leave when he was first charged in August, 5 months later, in January of 2015, he was finally fired. His trial began November 2nd, 2015, and he faced 36 charges, including sexual battery, assault, forcible oral sodomy, and stalking. He pleaded not guilty to all of them. And like I said earlier, there was an all-white jury in this case. 8 men and 4 women. In court, prosecutors produced DNA evidence that they found on a triangle-shaped spot on the inside of Daniel's uniform pants, close to the zipper. The DNA belonged to a victim who was only 17 years old at the time.
Oh my God.
Daniel's defense team says that the DNA could be secondary transfer, having come from him touching the victim just normally and then transferred to his pants by his own hands. They also claim that there was male DNA present on the pants that was never tested and believe this calls into question the DNA evidence. I don't believe that it does, and neither did the jury.
Mm-hmm.
Daniel did not deny having come into contact with these women because he couldn't, because his GPS put him with all of these women. But he did claim that he did nothing untoward with them. His defense focused on the victims' lifestyles, aggressively questioning them about their marijuana use, drinking, theft, and suspended licenses in an effort to undermine their credibility. Despite this, the victims' stories remained consistent. The defense called only one witness, an ex-girlfriend, who says that Daniel never exhibited sexually aggressive or inappropriate behavior towards her. Daniel's supporters say he had no history of inappropriate behavior towards women and that this whole investigation was a witch hunt. But that really means nothing because, first of all, let's look at who he was victimizing.
Exactly.
Black women.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very intentional, not just because they're not going to be taken as seriously, but because the way Black women are fetishized and viewed differently than other women, it doesn't surprise me that someone who had no history of sexual aggression towards non-Black women would be more aggressive towards Black women. Yeah. This is like, there's a long historical precedent of that type of behavior.
And it's common. That doesn't surprise me at all. Of course, the people in his life said he's always respectful towards women. He was probably never around Black women and definitely never around Black women with criminal records, right? Of course, he was respectful to the type of women he would date.
And that's, I think,
that's different.
Yeah. That's like when people will be like, oh, no, like, my boyfriend, he's not misogynistic, but then like your boyfriend is only nice to you.
And like other women attracted to you.
Yeah. That's like this idea, like if men are only nice to women that they find attractive, they're not actually nice to women. Like if he never exhibited aggressive behavior towards women, except Black women, guess what? He's exhibiting aggressive behavior towards women.
Yeah.
So like I said, ultimately the jury did find Daniel guilty of 18 of the 36 charges, including first degree rape, sexual battery, indecent exposure, stalking, forcible oral sodomy, and burglary. He was sentenced to 263 years in prison. The jury said that while the DNA evidence was compelling, it was really the victim testimony that had the most impact. One juror specifically mentioned that the testimony of the 17-year-old victim whose DNA was found on Daniel's pants was very emotional and moving. This girl testified that Daniel raped her on her mother's front porch when he came to threaten her with an outstanding warrant for trespassing. I just want to say, he would have known she was 17.
Yeah.
Like that's a really important detail.
Yeah.
If he knew where she lived and he knew she had a warrant, he would have known that she was 17.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
So I have a quote here from that girl. "What am I going to do?" she asked. "Call the cops?" He was a cop. And this goes back to what we were saying earlier. It's like, who do you call when they're the ones harming you? The jury did end up convicting him of every single count related to her assault. So while several jurors expressed sympathy for Daniel's family and girlfriend, they all have stood by the verdict. Daniel's team immediately appealed the ruling, but all of his appeals have been denied. Despite this, he continues to assert his innocence. And it's not just Daniel. And this is where some of this controversy comes in. His family and friends maintain his innocence. And there was a huge movement, particularly on the right, that believe he is innocent. This includes a founding board member of the Innocence Project.
Wow.
So when I read that was the first thing that gave me pause. And that's why I didn't cover this case last season, because I was like, that's crazy. But I don't know. It's this idea that like these people support the justice system only when it's convenient to them. Like,
right
now the justice system is corrupt and can't be trusted because you're being harmed by it. But mm-hmm. You expect me to believe all of these women lied. Every single one.
Right.
Like this guy was a cop with a degree in criminal justice. He was able to cover up the evidence, but you can't cover up a victim's story.
All of these women lied, and all of their stories matched up so well with to information they wouldn't even have access to.
No, like they had no access to the GPS data or anything like that. His supporters insist that much of the witness and officer testimony presented at the by the prosecution is based on solicited testimony by felons, prostitutes, and others who would have personal motives beyond the basic truth to fabricate their stories. Again, this goes to who he targeted. He knew that people would not believe these women, and yet the jury did anyway. I think that's why the idea that people think that he might be innocent is like really like unsettling to me, because it is not. Do you know how few people are convicted of sexual assault?
Right. And then on top of that, he's a cop.
Yeah. Like he had everything going for him, and still the jury was that moved by this witness testimony, by the 13 women who share their testimony. Like, even though that they were felons, prostitutes, and people with personal motives, they were still more believable than he was. Like, there's something to be said for that.
Yeah.
These people also claim that the DNA evidence used to convict him was unfair, along with the full trial, but the jurors said that the DNA evidence wasn't really what moved the needle. It was the witness testimony. And I just want to go back, like, all of the things used to convict Daniel that his team is claiming is unfair, I bet he had no issue when those were used to convict the people he was arresting.
No, I'm sure he didn't. And I'm also sure that the way in which people are picking apart these women was part of his tactic and who he was choosing to assault in the first place. Like, it was, it seemed extremely premeditated. That's what's like almost not
it was
funny. It's also disturbing, but he had a like systemically like chose who to assault in order to be like who was the least perfect victim,
which is something that, again, as a police officer, like he would have known exactly how to find the perfect victim.
Exactly.
So he is rotting in prison where he belongs. But I do want to just note that hundreds of police officers have been terminated for sexual abuse in recent years, but only a very small number of them ever faced criminal charges, and even fewer were convicted. A 2015 Associated Press investigation highlighting this rampant issue of sexual abuse in policing found that about 1,000 officers in the U.S. lost their license for sexual misconduct over a six-year period. And the investigators believe that this was an undercount because some states don't have a method for banning problem officers for sexual misconduct.
Mm-hmm.
And as a woman, I can say that stories like this really scare me because police have access to so much information about you. They can pull you over and look at your ID and they know where you live. They can direct you to pull over on the side of the road on an abandoned highway. Like, they have so much power. And many, many police officers use that power to harm women.
And like, let's talk about it. Like, sexual assault, rape is not about sex. It's about power. Mm-hmm. And when you're looking at this group of people that clearly have some sort of aptitude for power, like, and then who are also given so much unlimited power, like, the people we need to be the most vigilant about would be police. And there's just really no sort of accountability. I don't know. I don't even think accountability is what I would want. I want like prevention.
Yeah. And I think what's tough is like, let's put on our little liberal reformers hat. what do you do to reform this when what you make a man and a woman go together for every single call as if these officers won't cover for each other?
Mm-hmm.
As if they won't turn a blind eye to these crimes. We know that they do. There was actually an episode of Law and Order SVU. I know I bring up Law and Order like every other week. I know I do. But there was an episode, I don't know if it was based off this case, it might have been, where a cop would pick up drunk girls that were getting kicked out of clubs, and he and his partner would drive them home, except he would take them upstairs and assault them. And his partner, who was a woman in this Law and Order story, would just sit downstairs and wait. Like, life imitates art. Do we think that that wouldn't happen in real life if you just like, oh, well, we solve this problem by like not letting men be alone? And even then, like, what? So we don't let men be alone? We just can't let men. So let's just get rid of all male cops. Is that the solution that y'all want? Like,
it's a good start. I'll get rid of a good bit of them.
Yeah. No, and maybe that's what we do. But no, like, how do you reform a system like this? There's so much oversight. Even him, every time he looked up someone's name, that was recorded. All of his movements within his car, that was recorded. And yet he still, for 2 years, was able to go and assault these women. Like, how do you stop stuff like this without just getting rid of police? If you're out there with an answer, I'd love to hear it. But I don't see how you do it.
Yeah.
And women shouldn't have to fear being assaulted by police. But to be fair, no one in our society should have to fear police, yet so many do. You know, Black people mm-hmm. shouldn't have to be afraid to be pulled over and shot. Women shouldn't have to be afraid of them looking up their address and showing up at their house to assault them. Like, regular people shouldn't have to worry about police officers selling them drugs or selling drugs in their communities, which we just talked about last episode. Like, there's so much fear around policing just inherently, not even just coming from like us radical people who are against policing. Like, so much of policing is fear-based in general. And Absolutely. Why are we choosing to live that way?
Like, we have to let go of this, like, dream of safety, of that they're, like, some, like, ever-present, like, being that is keeping us safe. They're bringing so much harm. And yeah. fear. And, like, fear and living not, like, the only violence isn't, like, physical violence that you experience. There's violence to living in fear of another entity. Like, that is physically harmful as well.
Yeah. And I mean, going back to like, how could you stop this? Well, the first thing is, I don't think that we need traffic stops.
Yeah.
And I feel like some people think that's really controversial, but traffic stops are very dangerous, not just for the people being pulled over, but they're dangerous for police officers. Like, that's mm-hmm. something that's actually been talked about by police, is that the reason that they have to be willing to shoot anyone at any moment during a traffic stop is because it's so dangerous, and because they do sometimes get killed during traffic stops. If it is that dangerous for police and it's that dangerous for civilians, why do we keep doing them? We don't need to. Let's lean into the liberal reformer surveillance state world where we just, I don't know, have like cameras on the highway where, like, if somebody's driving like real crazy, you send someone out. But like,
or why do we have people literally just mail them a ticket? Like, we already
mail them a ticket.
We already have that system. Like, yeah. that exists.
And even
Why
then,
is that not enough?
Even then, I'm like, I don't really know about that, because I don't like the surveillance of it all. But like, that's a better solution than just pulling people over.
It's a better solution, and it already exists. Like, we already have all of that. Like, we don't need them there.
Like, there is not a single reason for us to continue to have traffic stops.
No.
And I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've been driving down the street and been like, where are the cops? Look at these people driving reckless. They're never there when you actually need them anyway. Like,
right. But God forbid you say that and someone hears, because then they'll try to ruin your life, i.e. drone.
Yeah. Yes. So, I mean, this story was hard for me because I'm like, it's all of the stories we talk about are scary, but like this one in particular, to me personally, was very scary because like this could be any woman, yeah, just minding her business.
Yeah.
So I know that's kind of heavy.
As it always is.
And yeah.
Yeah.
And this kind of, I don't have like a super positive, bright note to end on, but I think it brings back to the conversation that we'll keep trying to have or keep driving is like, what does a world without police look like? We already talked about traffic stops, like how that could be handled, how it's already being handled in a lot of places. Like, we don't need traffic stops. Let's eliminate that right there. What are other aspects of policing that we could eliminate really, really easily? Cops in schools. Super easy one that we can get rid of right away. They're not protecting people. They're not stopping school shootings. They're not stopping school fights. They're not doing anything.
And it's just a drain of resources.
It's a huge drain of resources. It's just continuing the school to prison pipeline. Like, it's not benefiting anyone. Get rid of it. Traffic stops. They're not benefiting everyone. Anyone, get rid of it. Like, what else? Like, what else are police doing that? It's like, what are you there for? As is, police are just there to investigate after the fact. So why have them on the street at all?
Yeah. I was one time in my neighborhood. Someone had like shot and I could see everything like out my window. And the cops came and these like detectives pulled up and they literally like pulled out notepads. I'm like, right. I was like, how does it feel to have a fake job? Like, that can't be real.
No, because I could show up to a crime scene and take notes.
Right? Like, what do you
a fifth grader could show up to a crime scene and take notes.
What, like, notes are you taking on your notepad? What year is this? Where are we? Like,
so stupid. Such a waste of time and resources. And if we took money away from that, we could put money towards things that actually do help people.
Yeah.
Like, survivors funds, because, you know, something they talk about with abolitionists, they're like, well, what are you going to do about the rapists? What are you going to do about them? And I'm like, what are we doing about them now?
What are we doing about them now? And like, let's not pretend that our culture that is heavily built around policing doesn't educate people to cause harm to others. Like,
yeah,
does not encourage sexual harm. Like,
no, 100%. So to the people who are like, well, what are you going to do about the rapists? Well, we're not doing anything about them now. So at least we could take away some of the funding that police have and put that funding towards better sex ed, better education on consent, which I think will only take us so far. Because the reality is we live in a patriarchal society where women are viewed as property. And that leads to assault. And I know that's a hard pill to swallow for some people. Guess what? Women have to deal with, have to swallow that pill every single day. We know every single day how vulnerable we are. But I would rather money go away from policing and towards victim compensation and victim support than towards policing, because when I was assaulted, police did nothing for me. And there was nothing that they could have done for me. But if we had like adequate resources, if I would have been able to like get, you know, financial support, therapy, all of those things, like right when that happened, like that would have actually helped me.
Right. And then maybe we could be pouring less money into this system that literally fetishizes power, which is, yeah, such a root of so much like sexual violence.
100%. 100%. So back to, you know, the original point is, let's be thinking about a world without police. Like, we need you all to do the thinking. We're doing the thinking. We're wanting to have this conversation. I know we keep bringing it up, but it's because it's kind of what we're doing here. That's kind of the whole point of this podcast. So
it matters so much. And like, we have ideas, we have thoughts, and we're happy that you come here each week to listen to them, but abolition is like only practiced fully and truly in community. So we're trying to build that with you.
And we appreciate like how bought in so many of y'all are, because we know that you are thinking about these things. We know that you are feeling moved by these stories. And my hope is that you're not hearing them and like getting really depressed and down. Like, I don't want you to listen to them and be like, nope, this is fine that we live in a society that's like this. But like, I do hope that you listen to them and are like, you know what? Yeah, this is awful that this is happening in our society, but like, I can picture a better day.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to work within my community to bring about that better day. We talked a few episodes ago about like, there's not a legislative path. There's not a legislative path to abolishing police. Like, that's not something that's going to happen through our political realm. But it can be something that happens by making policing obsolete, by investing in communities, by caring for those around you, by educating those around you, things like that. And so I'm hoping that like this podcast is helping you feel moved to do those steps to help make policing obsolete.
And making it apparent that policing is obsolete. Like, hopefully this podcast is providing like the real life tangible examples that policing is in fact obsolete. And then on top of that, like the work that you're doing in your individual communities, the conversations that you're having, the care that you're providing is answering those questions of, but what would we do if insert horrible thing happens? And then we can shoot right back as, well, the cops are the ones doing those. And here's ways that I would care for my community better.
Absolutely. You know, back to that, well, what are we going to do with the rapists? Get them out of the police force.
Step one.
Start with that. So thank you all for listening. I know that this one was like, there was a lot more graphic content than normal, but I felt like, especially with the controversy around this story, it needed to be told in earnest with the details. And I appreciate y'all listening. I appreciate y'all taking that in and thinking about it. And, you know, we just appreciate y'all for being here with us.
We appreciate you so much. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you for being in community around something that affects us all and matters so much.
As always, make sure you're engaging with us on social media. Post about this episode if you feel so moved. Post about former episodes. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell everyone except your local police, because we really don't need them in our business. But otherwise, we'll see y'all next week.
We'll see you next week. Thank you.